All rise.
Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice.
Good morning. Please be seated. We are here in the matter of Cornella versus Churchill County. It's case number 56329. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew DeGesti, and I'm here today representing the petitioner, Mary Lou Cornella. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. As I was sitting here this morning waiting for argument to begin, I was going over my opening statement, which I had practiced a few times. And I looked up and I noticed on the court seal that it says, fiat justitia. And if my Latin's correct, that means let justice be done. And that's actually better than the opening statement that I had prepared, because justice has not been done in this case. And that's why we're here today. And specifically, we're looking at statute NRS 484.3775. And we're asking the court to grant relief to Mary Lou on basic issues. The first is that the statute's unconstitutional because it's void for vagueness. And the second is if the court disagrees and finds that the statute is constitutional, it actually requires an underlying unlawful act or omission to trigger liability. And that wasn't proven at the proceedings below. And so if I may, I'd like to get into the first issue. The statute violates the Due Process Clause because it fails to overcome the void for vagueness test as stated by this court in Flamingo Paradise Gaming. There's two components to this test, and either one can be shown to be void in order to render the statute unconstitutional. The first component is that ordinary people, or people, excuse me, of ordinary intelligence, do not understand or not put on notice of what conduct is prohibited. And it's Mary Lou's position that the statute is vague because people of ordinary intelligence do not understand. It's based on simple negligence. And simple negligence is not specific conduct. Simple negligence is a legal concept, which in Mary Lou's opinion, it defines a range of unreasonable conduct. It's not tantamount to saying you cannot run a red light. That's specific conduct. It's not tantamount to saying you cannot exceed a speed limit of 35 miles per hour. That is specific conduct. It's a legal concept, and it's vague. And people don't understand when just looking at the plain language of the statute exactly what conduct is prohibited. And that's the first problem with it.
Mr. DeGesti, there have been a number of cases that equate some simple negligence to ordinary negligence, and ordinary negligence has been recognized as a permissible standard for determining criminal conduct so long as the offense is a misdemeanor offense. What's your position with regard to those authorities?
And I agree with you to a certain extent, Your Honor. The cases that were cited are cases that, for the most part, state that ordinary negligence is a permissible mens rea. It's not unconstitutional for the legislature to prescribe ordinary negligence as a mens rea. There's only one case that the state cites where it says ordinary negligence overcomes the void for vagueness test. And that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about whether it's a permissible mens rea. We're talking about whether it overcomes void for vagueness. And that case is a Michigan case, which I believe was the state versus McGee. And I provided this case to counsel, and I apologize that this case was not brought up in the briefing because I found it last night, and that's the honest truth. And this is also a Michigan case, a Michigan Supreme Court case. And the importance of this particular case is that, like I said, the one case where the state cites to something that says ordinary negligence is not void for vagueness comes from Michigan. And that was either in the 50s or 60s. Forgive me, I forget. But this new case, which is People versus Traubert, and the citation is 439N.W.2D.231, it's in a different context. There, the court held that the information violated the defendant's due process rights because it was not sufficiently clear as to what conduct was being alleged. The information basically said that they violated the criminal statute because they were negligent. And there the court held, and I'd like to quote, negligence is a general word Its legal definition is about as indefinite as the word itself. It has no such concrete significance in language that it charges to general understanding a definite act or omission. Court goes on to state, charging an act as having been done negligently without specifying in what the negligence consisted is no more enlightening than would be a blanket charge of general fraud or crime. Lastly, the negligent homicide statute sets up no definite standard of conduct or test of negligence. And so the one court the state can point to has actually backtracked on that opinion that the state cites to. Again, it's not in the same context. It's in a different context, but they are clearly stating, and I believe opening the door for an attack on the constitutionality of that state's ordinary negligence criminal statute. I'd like to move to the second prong of the void for vagueness argument. And the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, has stated that this prong is actually more important than the first. And this prong can be proven. The first and second don't have to be proven. Either one can be proven. But this one, and this is where the problem really lies. This, you need to provide sufficient minimal guidelines for law enforcement to enforce the law. If there's no guidelines, no sufficient minimal guidelines, then it's arbitrary, it can be discriminatory, and that violates due process rights. And let's just jump to this case, because I think it actually provides the best example of arbitrary law enforcement. Mary Lou was originally charged with the violation. Of NRS 484.319. That was in count one, which basically stated she failed to yield the right of way to a bicyclist approaching from the opposite direction on a roadway. That was the exact language that the state used as the predicate offense in count two. They didn't cite
motorist or a bicyclist.
Excuse me?
Motorist or a bicyclist?
A bicyclist.
Okay.
But you keyed in on the issue that got count one dismissed. They failed to prove a material element. So they charged the wrong statute. But they use that exact same language in count two. The case proceeds. They examine their witnesses based on a violation of that statute. We cross-examine their witnesses based on a violation of that statute. They put up an expert whose opinion supports a violation of that statute. We cross-examine that expert. And then when they close their case in chief, we file our motion to dismiss. The court agrees. This is the theory they proceeded on from the inception of the case all the way up through the close of their case in chief. At that moment, evidence is closed. Argument then opens, but the evidence is closed. That is their theory. We get count one dismissed, and then the state jumps up and says, in arguing against the dismissal of count two, that we don't need a predicate underlying offense. It can be any act of negligence. They use the word limitless. And all of a sudden, we proceed from a violation of NRS 44.319 to no less than 10 different theories of liability after the close of their case in chief. It changed. It changed 10 different times. And that's not only a notice issue, but it's an arbitrary enforcement issue. It's a patent arbitrary enforcement issue. How is she supposed to defend against these 10 theories of liability? She can't.
Well, can you give me an example of a couple of alternative theories that were offered by the state in order to preserve the count two complaint?
I can't. I mean, we detailed them for you, Your Honor, in our briefing. So if you turn to page 16 of our opening brief, mm-hmm. our repetition, excuse me. You'll see the bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the different theories that they proceeded under. For a violation of NRS 44.3775, an underlying traffic violation must occur. A defendant may not take risks while driving, while not really defining what those risks might be. A third party could see the decedent, so the petitioner has an automatic duty to also see the decedent. The driver must watch out for all bicyclists. The driver is strictly liable for failing to do their best to avoid collisions with other human beings. Now it's not about bicyclists, it's just about human beings. And not to belabor the point, but I'll highlight one more. The petitioner had a duty to watch out for the decedent when the decedent was within the scope of the petitioner's visibility of her vision. What does that mean? How do you defend against that? And how do you defend against that when the state's case in chief has been closed? You can't. It's arbitrary. And then, tellingly, really for the final example of the arbitrariness of the enforcement here, you'll note in their answering brief in the very last section, they courageously state that, well, if the court does find that an underlying offense is necessary, then there was sufficient evidence to show that she violated 484.324. They found a traffic violation that dealt with bicyclists, and they're arguing it for the first time here before the court. Not in the charging documents, not at justice court, not on appeal at the district court, but for the first time here. And it's basically saying, Your Honor, sorry we messed up, but there was enough evidence to convict her under this statute, so just go ahead and affirm the conviction. It's arbitrary. And there's nothing Mary Lou can really do to defend against it, other than to argue that the statute is void for vagueness.
Mr. Digesti, assuming that the statute is unambiguous in requiring an unlawful act, in effect, the statute imposes strict liability for any incident in which death occurs. Is that your argument?
If the statute is unambiguous?
If the statute is unambiguous in its requirement of an unlawful act, then the statute essentially results in strict liability.
I'm confused, Your Honor. Are you saying that if the statute requires an underlying act, does it impose strict liability?
Well, there seems to be a dispute about whether the statute is ambiguous or not in its requirement of an unlawful act. If it does not require an unlawful act, does the statute become strictly liable or impose strict liability simply because a death occurs?
I don't believe it does. You still have this concept of negligence where, in theory, there's certain conduct that would not be considered negligent. It's an accident.
Well, I guess there are certain acts which would not be unlawful.
That's correct.
For which negligence could still occur.
And that's part of the problem. You have this area where the statute's punishing lawful conduct. It's creating this whole new area where you're punishing lawful conduct. You're criminalizing lawful conduct. And I believe what the legislature was attempting to do was to recognize and enhance the punishment for unlawful conduct that results in a death. And I'll be brief, and I apologize for not getting to the second issue, but if you look at the legislative history, if you look at the purpose behind bringing it, if you look at the context in which the assembly women and men spoke, the questions that were asked by the individuals who were hearing the testimony, and the victim impact statements, every single example that's given, even the hypotheticals that were presented, contain a traffic violation. Citizens of this state were disgusted with the fact that a family member could die or be killed as a result of someone running a stop sign and that person walked away with a violation for just running a stop sign. There was no difference between someone who ran a stop sign and killed someone versus someone who just ran a stop sign, and that's all that happened. And that was the purpose behind the legislation. That was the intent of the legislature when they passed this bill. Now, it was stated that it could have been written a little more clearly. Simple negligence could have been more defined. But the legislature, after Ben Graham's testimony, and Ben Graham specifically stating that the definition, a violation of this statute requires an underlying traffic violation, the panel said, we will trust in the integrity of the district attorney's office, and we will proceed and pass that bill as written.
Where in the language of the statute do you find an ambiguity? What portion of the statute specifically do you consider to be ambiguous?
Your Honor, if you looked at the act or omission portion of the statute, It's silent as to whether the act or omission can be lawful, unlawful, or either one of the two. It just doesn't state. And as Your Honor wrote in the Backer versus State Engineer opinion, if a statute is silent as to a certain portion of it, it's ambiguous. Because reasonably well-informed persons could consider that statute to both target lawful or unlawful conduct. It's not unreasonable to think that it could target both or be meant to apply to both. And because it's silent, just as under the reasoning in Backer, it's ambiguous. You got to look past the language of the statute.
OK.
And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal with the permission of the court.
Mr. DeGiusti, because we asked you a question at the very last moment, I will give you an additional minute in your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, should you need additional time, I would also provide that to you. Wait to see.
May it please the court. Good morning, Justices. My name is Ben Shawcroft. I'm a Deputy District Attorney from Churchill County, where in October of 2008, a 12-year-old girl named Brittany Cardell was struck and killed as she was riding her bicycle home from soccer practice. She was struck by the petitioner as she was driving her truck through town. Now, the statute 484, which is now 44B657, is under attack for its constitutionality. We are here to argue that the language in the statute is not void for vagueness. In fact, it very much provides sufficient notice to enable persons of ordinary intelligence to understand what conduct is prohibited. Additionally, it contains a specific standard, that of simple negligence, which is an objective standard, thus discouraging discriminatory enforcement. As this court knows in its pronouncement in Flamingo versus Chanos, there is a bit of a higher threshold when dealing with statutes and questioning their constitutionality and whether or not they are unconstitutionally vague. And that is, the question is, does vagueness so permeate the text that the statute cannot meet the test in most cases? Put another way, the statute should be found to be constitutional if, in most circumstances, that two-factor test is satisfied. And justices, simple negligence is understood in most applications by drivers who are on our roadways. They understand what simple negligence entails. They go through, and I just, going back to a case that was cited in our brief, the Michigan Appeals Court said, the term negligence is so well known, the elements so certain, the definition so definitely settled, and the precedent so many that there is nothing indefinite whatsoever about it. They said that under circumstances such as these. Drivers go through a litany of tests to ensure that they understand how to safely operate their motor vehicle. They go hands-on, they do a written test to ensure they understand what the rules of the roads are. Thus, their awareness of what kind of conduct or what type of omissions will create the risk that someone will be harmed by their operation of their motor vehicle. Additionally, we are all exposed almost daily to reports of horrific accidents, which oftentimes are caused by mere negligence, by mere inattention. And thus, drivers, again, their awareness is heightened by all of these things, telling them, if you do this, somebody's going to get hurt. This is the kind of conduct which is going to create that risk that someone will be hurt or even killed, as in this case. And thus, in most applications, they do understand what simple negligence means. They understand what kind of that if they are negligent in any manner, that risk will be created. Additionally, we have to understand that there have been these cases, specifically the U.S. Supreme Court in Morissette versus United States. They recognized the emergence of these public welfare offenses, where strict liability or even negligence may be the standard under which culpability may ensue. That was recognized also by and followed by additional courts. These offenses are created by our legislature in order to make dangerous environments more safe. We need them because our roadways and other industries are dangerous in their nature. And we need something broad enough to encompass the limitless ways in which drivers may be negligent and thus creating that danger on our roadways. We need something to persuade them to be more careful, to pay attention to the way in which they are driving. Going to the second part of that test that must be satisfied, simple negligence, again, is a specific enough standard discouraging and preventing arbitrary enforcement. And we need to just compare it to some terms that this court has struck down as being too vague and compare that with simple negligence and see the differences. For example, a law making it a misdemeanor to annoy a minor was struck down by this court in City of Las Vegas versus 8th Judicial District. Annoy, it was found to be too subjective. It might mean 10 different things to 10 different people. Similarly, a law prohibiting loitering that manifests the purpose of inducing prostitution was struck down by this court. manifests. Again, that was too subjective. It means different things to different people. Simple negligence is an objective standard. It doesn't mean something different to 10 different people. It is similar to a term that this court found to be specific enough to meet due process standards. And that term was endanger, that this court analyzed in Nelson v. State. And in that case, this court said, although innumerable specific acts could be listed that would constitute felonious behavior under the statute provides clear guidelines for an adjudicated body to determine whether a violation has occurred. Endanger was found to be objective. It is similar to simple negligence, which is also objective. In the example, as proposed by the petitioner in her brief, where a child darts out between two vehicles, the driver does nothing wrong, is going the speed limit, has no chance to stop or prevent striking that child, and he thinks, or she thinks, that under those circumstances, any officer could still cite that driver because simple negligence is subjective. We have to understand there has to be some kind of negligence. There has to be evidence which is objective for the officer to be able to see that there's simple negligence which proximately causes the death of another person.
And you don't think the two law enforcement agents might see that or interpret it differently and therefore allow for an inappropriate manner of enforcement?
I don't think so, because simple and negligence, again, there has to be something that they can observe and see that there was some negligence on the part of the driver. If they see absolutely nothing and they read the statute and go, there has to be some kind of simple negligence, there has to be some degree of fault on the driver. If there is zero fault, which is recognized by the legislators in passing this statute, they won't be charged. They won't be cited.
So there'd be no charge whatsoever under your hypothetical. The person would, who was driving the vehicle would walk away.
With zero fault on the part of the driver, since there is no negligence on the part of the driver, that element does not exist under that hypothetical. So there charges would not be able to be brought against that driver.
Would the driver in that hypothetical be liable if their taillights were out?
Well, again, we have to look at proximate cause. The proximate cause of the taillights being out, well, is that the proximate cause then that results in the traffic accident, which in striking the child? There wouldn't be any proximate cause. The taillights had nothing to do with the ensuing collision with the child. So in that type of scenario, again, we have to look at the proximate cause element. If there is none, we wouldn't be able to bring charges against that driver.
What if there was some other traffic violation that was occurring, but there was an issue about proximate cause? Say the driver's brakes were potentially not operable or deficient in their operation, which would constitute a traffic violation, but the child darted out and was nevertheless killed.
But if there is that proximate cause, again, if we can see that whatever the degree of negligence is on the part of the driver, if there's a line between that and that, again, and the resulting death of the child who darts out, then charges will be brought. If there is, in addition to that, a traffic violation, which again, if there is no break between that traffic violation and the death of the child, then there will be.
So your argument is that, and I understand in your briefs that you've argued that the act or omission language in the statute is clear and unambiguous, and it does not require an unlawful act.
That's correct.
All right. So I guess your position would be then that the cap on arbitrary and capricious enforcement of the statute resides in the proximate cause requirement.
That's correct, yes. That's correct. And so I guess we could take that a little bit further in saying if, like you said in the example of a taillight being out, there would be no strict liability just because he had a traffic violation in having his taillight out.
Mm-hmm.
So in every,
why
in every
was
case,
it necessary, it counsel? Why was it necessary to argue all of these other theories to sustain count two after count one had been dismissed in this case?
Well, I think we have to look
There's a lot of theories here that weren't charged.
Those aren't different theories that we were using. That was evidence that we were using to support the main theory, which was that the petitioner was that she failed to yield to the bicyclist who was using that intersection.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about that, she wasn't looking out for others who were using the intersection, that is evidence that we were using to support the theory that she was failing to yield. We were using the general term of failure to yield, but then using these specific acts or specific acts of negligence, which fell under that umbrella of failure to yield. So we were not changing the theory every 5 minutes during the trial.
Even under a simple negligence theory, you've got to identify what act occurred for which the defendant committed simple negligence. And so you're saying that those acts consisted of she didn't do her best to avoid colliding with human beings. She should have seen the decedent when the decedent approached in the intersection. Those are the acts that you're talking about?
Right. Those are the specific acts of failure on the part of that driver, which, under our broad umbrella of failure to yield, fell under that umbrella. She should have seen Brittany as she was directly in front of her, which fell under the general theory of failure to yield.
So what's to prevent prosecution in the hypothetical that counsel argues when the state says, should have seen the child darting out from between the two cars? You've indicated that wouldn't be the subject of a prosecution. It sort of sounds similar to a claim that the petitioner should have seen the decedent, regardless of where the decedent approached the intersection.
Well, where the in the, in the
how, hypo- how do you distinguish the hypothetical there from the child darting?
We certainly can. A child darting out between vehicles. And under the hypothetical proposed by petitioner, the driver really did have no chance to see that child because the child was nowhere and then was right in the road with giving no chance to see the child before it happened. In our case,
what's to prevent the officer from saying, well, you should have noticed the fact that the child was in the front yard and anticipated that the child would run out into the street. My concern here, and I'm raising it because I'm asking you to assuage me of the concern, if the panel were to agree that the statute is unambiguous in requiring an unlawful act, then it seems to me that the question is whether the statute is subjected to arbitrary and capricious enforcement because it opens the door for matters or acts that are on a determination by the law enforcement officer on a case-by-case basis. Can you assuage my concern on the second prong under Flamingo?
I think so. I think we have to go back and remind ourselves that we are looking at the conduct of the driver. And as I've already argued before, proximate cause is the big issue here. And I think we would be hard pressed to find an officer who says you should have seen the child playing in their front steps of their house as you're driving through this neighborhood. What we do want to have happen are drivers who are aware as they're going through intersections, as they're going even through residential neighborhoods, of everything that's happening there. Everybody who's using that intersection or attempting to use that intersection. And so the officer is going to be looking at, is there simple negligence on the part of the driver? Did it approximately cause the death of the other person? And if if they're unable to say, yes, there was simple negligence, or if they are unable to say, I have probable cause to believe there is simple negligence, they're not going to be issuing that citation. I truly believe we will be hard pressed to find an officer who would cite under the hypothetical as stated by petitioner, where there is no chance whatsoever to see the child darting out between the vehicles. We don't have that here. We have a child who was in clear view, looking. If you were looking this way or that way, and the child coming along the pathway into the intersection, indeed, she failed to yield to that bicyclist. She should have seen her, and was negligent in operating her vehicle that day.
Counsel, you don't dispute, but that the legislative history in regard to this bill spent a significant period of time talking about what simple negligence is. Do you?
They discussed it somewhat, and I do recall that the discussion they had on that, but it didn't go so far as saying that we were requiring an underlying offense involved there.
Even those who supported the bill seemed to be concerned about the definition of simple negligence. You would agree with that, correct?
Well, there was some concern about that, sure. I believe my time is up.
Questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. DeGesti.
Thank you, Your Honor.
There's three points I'd like to highlight. Hopefully I can get it done in 2 minutes, so we'll see what we can do. The first, to focus on what Justice Hardesty said, you're worried about the subjectivity of the enforcement, and I agree 100%. The state argues that this statute is clear, it's unambiguous, and that all you need to do is look to the language of the statute to understand what conduct is prohibited. But in the same brief, the state goes on to look to outside factors to define what simple negligence is. So what does a driver in this state need to do according to the state to know how to comply with this statute? They have to know the traffic laws, which, by the way, is all the public welfare offenses this state needs in order to regulate traffic. Number two, the driver's license application process informs them what negligence is. That's not contained in the language of the statute. That's an outside factor. And in fact, to make it personal, during my driver's license exam, I actually got docked for looking over my left shoulder. The state convicted and prosecuted Mary Lou for not doing that. That's important. It's arbitrary. The third thing is you have to look to media coverage of other vehicular fatalities. That doesn't do anything for anybody to help understand what this statute prohibits. So it is subjective, it is arbitrary, and it's unconstitutional. And I'll just skip to my third point really quickly, jumping to the public policy, if this statute were allowed to go forward, is constitutional. NRS 41.141 in the civil context is our comparative negligence statute. It does not allow a defendant to recover monetary damages if they're 51% or more negligent. And so there's absolutely the possibility that if this statute does go forward, an individual can be convicted under this crime and then in the civil corresponding context not be liable to the plaintiff for any damages. You go to jail, but you don't owe any money. And that's a public policy problem. That's a due process violation that I think hopefully this court will address. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. DeGesti. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted. Or not?
Justice Sater, could I just make a comment?
Absolutely.
I see Tom here. I just want to compliment the lawyers in this case for their arguments. This is a tough case, and Mr. Shawcroft and Mr. DeGesti have done an outstanding job in oral argument. This is the way lawyers ought to argue cases in the Supreme Court, and I congratulate both of you, and I know my colleagues feel the same way. Really well done.
Thank you. All right.